been looking through the book of Romans, and I'm going to read to you Romans 11, verse 25 to 32. Lest you be wise in your own sight, I do not want you to be unaware of this mystery, brothers. A partial hardening has come upon Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. And in this way, all Israel will be saved, as it is written. The deliverer will come from Zion. He will banish ungodliness from Jacob. And this will be my covenant with them when I take away their sins. As regards the gospel, they are enemies for your sake. But as regards election, they are beloved for the sake of their forefathers. For the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. For just as you were at one time disobedient to God, but now have received mercy because of their disobedience, so they too have now been disobedient in order that by the mercy shown to you, they also may now receive mercy. For God has consigned all to disobedience, that he may have mercy on all. Well, finally, we've got to that bit in Romans. I've been promising you the controversial bit, and that is when Paul says, and all Israel will be saved. And maybe after we've looked at it, you might be disappointed and not quite worry what all the fuss was about. And I was just looking over my notes before the service, and something that struck me is that sometimes the Bible is relatively easy. There might be sometimes a few bits are a little bit involved, but it's often not that hard. But what becomes hard is when you have to deal with different viewpoints and Christians disagree. So when you have to sort of explain why this and not that, that's when it gets more complicated. And there's a bit where I will have to engage with that a little bit. There's lots of different views about this, but we'd look at what it does say. So the question to ask here, which I think helps a lot, is why is it here? What and why is Paul telling us this? And I think, like everything else, it would have had, when Paul put pen to paper, or whatever he used to papyrus, he needed to tell the Romans something. It had immediate practical use for the Romans and a practical use for us. And sometimes we need to ask the question, well, how are we like and how are we not like the Romans? And once we answer that, we see why something matters. I think rarely, if ever, are things in the Bible just for theological curiosity. From Genesis through to Revelation, everything has pressing relevance. Some things more obviously and more immediately, some you have to do a bit more work to see why it applies to us, but it is all, it all matters to us. So like all of chapter 9 to 11, it's about the Jewish and Gentile Christians and how they view themselves and each other, and to value each other properly. So, and the other thing they're meant to do that these chapters help them with is how they trust God and what God is doing, God's ways, what he's doing in the church and what he's doing in mission, especially when things are discouraging, as they sometimes are. And here is the point. This is why Paul's writing. He actually tells us why he's writing this bit. He says, lest you be wise in your own sight, I do not want you to be unaware of this mystery. Lest you be wise in your own sight. That's the point. So he says, I don't want you to be wise in your own sight. Now, actually, the word is just, it's actually a bit shorter in the Greek. He just says, literally, I don't want you to be ignorant. I don't want you to be ignorant. And the way he wants them to not be ignorant is for them to be informed about this mystery. So they need to be, and we need to be, humble and admit our ignorance and listen to what he's going to say. And this is also about the wider issue about Jews and Gentiles and how they relate in church, and how we see a bigger mission going on. And so to know the mystery. Now, the mystery, the word mystery, often when Paul says mystery, he means the gospel. But what he always means is something that's hidden but made known. So you didn't know about it, but now it's been revealed to you. It's been made known. And at the end of verse 25, you see that chain that we've seen before in these chapters. Israel has been hardened, and Israel hardening leads to the fullness of the Gentiles coming in. And that leads to verse 26, all Israel being saved. So already we'd seen Israel's rejection leads to Gentile acceptance, leads to this jealousy and some coming back. But this time he says, and all Israel will be saved. And it seems odd to us, but Paul is revealing to us a mystery. So just a recap very quickly of everything we've done for quite some time. So chapters 1 to 8, I'm obviously not going to do this in detail. Chapters 1 to 8 is the gospel. Paul is trying to raise support for his mission to Spain. And he talks about this whole plan of God. And to do so, he heavily uses the Old Testament and God's promises to show what his plan is. And then 9 to 11, been looking at for a month or two now, is about Israel. Why are there so few that are Christian? So chapter 9, he starts very near the beginning, says that not all Israel are Israel. So there's this big thing called Israel. But within this big thing called Israel, there's a small thing called Israel, a remnant. And that was always the case. All through the Old Testament, there was an unfaithful Israel and a faithful Israel. And also he talks about that is so for God's purposes in election. Chapter 10, he focuses on Israel's rejection and the need to proclaim the gospel to all. And then chapter 11, been looking at a couple of weeks now, a couple of questions. In verse 1, he shows that not all Israel have been rejected. So when they say Israel rejected, not all Israel had rejected. And in verse 11 onwards, that they're not all fallen beyond the point of coming back. But he talks about their hardening. The hardening of Israel means that the gospel has gone over to the Gentiles. And in turn, that happening has meant that Israel has become jealous, which involves this coming back in. And then last week, we looked at this olive tree illustration he uses. And it shows that there's one people of God, Jew and Gentile, but one people. And but the root and the trunk is Israel. And the Gentiles are grafted in. Faithless Israel is torn out. And so there's a warning that Gentiles, you don't think you're anything special. You're only in there because you remain there by faith. But you're not beyond removal for faithlessness. And there's a hope, therefore, that Israel would be all the more naturally grafted in when they come to faith. And as we've gone through this over the however many weeks, there's lots to say. That's why I've taken so many weeks. There's lots of practical implications as we went along. But two important complementary truths to sort of come away from all of it and bring us into this passage is that there's one olive tree. Not two olive trees, there's one olive tree. That is, there's one people of God. And there's one way to be saved, and that is by faith in Jesus Christ. And the basis of that is Israel. God doesn't start with a new tree. God doesn't go, I'll get rid of Israel. I'm going to start with Gentiles. The idea is that he has one tree, and rather these new people, these Gentiles, people like us, or the majority of us listening, are then grafted in to that already existing people of God. Now, I think that's important because what sometimes you might hear is replacement theology. If you haven't at some point, you will. So what's accused at people like at me, at people like us, is we've replaced Israel with the church. No, we haven't. Israel has not been replaced by the church. In the Old Testament, Israel was called, depending on how you translate the words, but like assembly or gathering, it's the same word church. They were the church in the desert. So they were the people of God. And Israel has now been expanded to us. In Galatians, Paul calls people of faith, Jew or Gentile, he says he calls them the Israel of God and Abraham's children. So we are included in, not that they've got rid of and we replaced them. It's a fulfillment, not a replacement. But Israel without faith is not Israel and never was. And these people who talk about replacement theology and don't like some of what I'm saying. The reason for that is because they want to keep Israel's very high status, which is understandable. But the danger is they go into either two olive trees or two roots to God. But we do need to explain then what we mean by all Israel will be saved and why it matters. And I want us to see a couple of things. I want us to see this wonderful symmetry in God's plan and then in it to see his gracious purpose. So the first thing is this wonderful symmetry, which you'll see in verses 24 to 27. So the Jews rejected the gospel and have become hardened to it, by and large. And that leads to the Gentiles receiving it. And in turn, that leads to this Jewish jealousy. And we looked at that last week, and that this jealousy isn't a bad thing. Jealousy isn't always a bad, negative thing. There's a kind of a right, godly kind of jealousy. And so this jealousy leads some back. So you've got this symmetry. The Jews' response leads to Gentile inclusion, and the Gentile response leads to a Jewish inclusion. Both groups at various stages look pretty hopeless, and God uses the other one to bring them to him. So God uses the Jews to bring the Gentiles to him. He uses the Gentiles to bring the Jews to him. Now, on the ground, the situation looks pretty random, but God uses rejection and acceptance for his glory, but also for our good. Now, we just touched on this phrase last week about full inclusion. So verse 12, it talks about the full inclusion of Israel. And now verse 26, the fullness of the Gentiles. It both is exactly the same word. It just means fullness or fullness of. It doesn't mean that everyone, every Jew, every Gentile, which is every non-Jew, will be included in salvation. That's already been discounted in Romans. We need to respond to Jesus Christ in faith. We've also seen that God has chosen some and not others. The NIV translates this the full number. Now, that's not the words that are being used, but they, rather than translated, they've interpreted, but they've got the sense of it there. They get the point. God has in mind a number. Actually, not just a random number. He also has in mind the names. But this number of Israel and a full number of Gentiles. And so what he's saying here is when that full number, when every individual that God's chosen is reached, all Israel will be saved. There we go. What could be easier? Apart from what does it mean? What does all Israel mean? Again, from what Paul's already told us and from the last few chapters, we can work out very easily what it does not mean. This is not a bad place to start. So it doesn't mean every Jew ever. Already we've seen that can't be the case. We've already seen not all Israel was Israel. So we can't mean all every Israelite, half Jew or whatever. He can't mean that. He doesn't mean the church. I'm going to say something scandalous, and it's going out on YouTube. But you've heard it here first. I'm disagreeing with John Calvin. So John Calvin believed that this meant the church. So all of God's elect, Old Testament, New Testament. I think he's wrong. He's not often. Now, true, the Israel of God in Galatians means the church. And what John Calvin says here works really tidily and nicely. But I don't think it quite works, because when Paul has said Israel all the way through chapters 9 to 11, he always means Israel as the group of people through time. But he means the Jewish people, a distinct ethnic group of people. And he's been grappling with this question, why haven't they all come to Jesus Christ? Now, what we may have done in saying that, and what we've already said, we may have answered that question. Not all Israel is Israel, but we mean this remnant, this faithful remnant will come to Christ. We've already said there's one olive tree, and we've seen this chain of from the Jews, it goes to the Gentiles and back to the Jews. We've already talked about the fullness of Israel, and when God reaches the fullness of the Gentiles, all Israel will be saved. We must mean all of the faithful remnant through time will be saved. All of those that have been faithful and will come to Christ from the Jews will be saved. You might think that doesn't sound very remarkable, but stick with me. Now, there's a version of this that believes, I don't think what we've said before is especially complicated, but there's a version of this that's very popular, which it states that when the Gentiles reach their fullness, at that point, there'll be a rapture. It's not mentioned in these verses, interestingly. There'll be a rapture, and then there'll be a new state of Israel established that will be ruled by Christ. And that's relates to this. Now, to say that involves taking something from Revelation 20 and reading it back. And that's why things are getting complicated. And Revelation 20 is actually quite a hard passage to start with. And you have to read that in its full context. I think that understanding as well is not quite right. It's a particular take on Revelation 20. Now, it's not bad in and of itself to read some other texts back into the text. We compare the Bible with the Bible, but we have to let every verse of the Bible speak for itself. We also have to go from the easy ones to the hard ones rather than the other way around. So we can't distort the natural reading. And actually, I think the next couple of verses explain this, where Paul takes us to the Old Testament. And actually, I don't think we're talking about the future at all, but the past. So the next couple of verses, 26 to 27, he says, "The deliverer will come from Zion. He will banish ungodliness from Jacob, and this will be my covenant with them when I take away their sins." Now, the quote, the footnote says, is from Isaiah 59, verses 20 to 21, but he has slightly modified it. So he's modified it with Isaiah 27, 9, where he says, when I take away their sin. Well, when did he take away their sin? Paul also says, the deliverer, if you look at the words in front of you, says the deliverer will come from Zion. Now, the Hebrew text of that psalm, of Isaiah, sorry, the Hebrew text of Isaiah says, to Zion, he will come to Zion. And the Greek Old Testament says, often called the Septuagint, that says, for the sake of Zion. But Paul doesn't say either. He says, from Zion. He's making a particular point. What Paul's saying is that the Old Testament prophesies that the deliverer will come from Zion. So the other idea of, you know, the Gentiles being raptured and a new state of Israel would mean that he would expect him to be coming to Zion. He says coming from Zion. The deliverer is going to come from there so that, verse 27, according to the covenant, he can take their sin. He's talking about the past. He's talking about the cross. So those reading the rapture into this, the fullness of Gentiles, all Israel, then Christ comes, established new state of Israel. No, Paul's looking back. Isaiah was looking forward and Paul is looking back. Now, like I said, sorry if that gets complicated. The Bible is not always easy or straightforward, but it is always clear. There's a phrase people use, the perspicuity of scripture, which is funny that that's an obscure phrase for what it means. But think of perspex. You can see through it. It's clear. The Bible is clear. It's not obscure. Sometimes requires a bit of work on our part, but it's nothing weird about it, even if it's involved. What gets complicated is when we make it complicated and we have to explain, well, we don't mean that and stuff like that. But sometimes we have to sort of go there because an idea has become popular. So when there's competing ideas, that's where it becomes complicated. But actually in itself, I think what Paul's saying is quite straightforward, relatively. There is one people of God. This is what Paul's saying. There's one people of God. There's one way of salvation. And God has used Jews and Gentiles for the good of the other, which leads us to God's gracious purpose in verses 28 to 32. So the history, the world, the church, all looks like a confusing mess to me most of the time. There's no discernible pattern, but that's not the case for God. And he says here that the Jews are enemies to the gospel, which sounds like a bad thing, but he says, but it's good for you, for your sake. It's been used for your good. Enemies of the gospel, but still loved by God, because of his covenant promises and call to Abraham. So yet again, he's saying this is an opportunity for God to show mercy. And notice verse 30, he says, just as. So just as the Gentile Christians were once disobedient, but found God's mercy, or rather it found us. And that through Israel's hardening. So via this path they're on, we have found mercy. And via that path, they will find it too. So the summary of all of this is actually, it brings it all together, is verse 32. In fact, in some ways, this is a summary of everything we've had in Romans up to this point. For God has consigned all to disobedience, that he may have mercy on all. So the natural condition, because we're in Adam that we thought about before, the natural condition, a default position is not neutrality. A default position is that people are opposed to God and God confirms that rebellion on them. That in itself is a judgment. So he says, right, you're going to reject me and my ways. Well, I will compound that on you. And that leads to a final judgment. In a sense, he exposes the extent of their rebellion. But he does so in order to show mercy. So he exposes the sinfulness of sin in order to show mercy. Again, it's seen in Romans, this offer to all. It doesn't mean that all will receive mercy. When he says shows mercy at all, it doesn't mean that all will receive mercy, but all have been shown mercy, all have been offered mercy. You only receive it by faith in Jesus Christ, as he's already made clear. So the purpose is to show God's gracious purposes. Even those rejecting the gospel, God has purposes for. God has not lost control or failed at any point. And as I said to start with, Paul gave the Romans this, the Roman church this, not because they were curious about obscure details, but for their good, and through them also for our good. So a few thoughts about this, about when you're thinking, well, this, okay, so it's not as frightening and scary and as weird as we thought, but why on earth does it matter? Some thoughts about this as we close. It is still quite a dense passage, and we've taken a bit of time over it. We've had to also deal with this relatively newish but popular understanding, and therefore we've got a bit more in depth. Even so, there is still a mysterious element to these chapters, and we have to be humble before it, that we may not have fully understood all the details and such like, and maybe can't. Hence verses 33 to 37, which we'll look at next week. But what we do need to see is that there is one people of God. Now, of course, there's lots of discrete congregations, even in our own town. There are different churches. We don't think that we're the only church. There are discrete congregations, but there is one people of God. In fact, not even one people across congregations, but across time, there's one people of God. And what Paul is addressing is Roman division, this looking down on one another. Either the Jews looking down on the Gentiles, because, you know, we're the originals, we're the real deal, or Gentiles looking down on the Jews, where, you know, you've all blown it. Or today, anyone looking down on anyone else in the church. So there's one people of God, but us Gentiles who've been included in, we've been included in. we're the new boys. As Jesus put it to the woman at the well, salvation is from the Jews. That is the root, and we're grafted in. And so for us Gentiles, there's no place to be conceited or arrogant or ignorant before anyone else. So we mustn't be ignorant of that. We are grafted in by grace. So Gentiles, which most of us are, need to be humble. We need to appreciate the grace that's been shown to us and the heritage that we've come from, that these forefathers of our faith aren't our biological forefathers. But Jews also have to be humble, because they actually were included on the same basis as well, which is grace. In different ways, but it's all grace. And that we've only been included by God's mercy. So to see in a chaotic world, most reject Christ. But God is sovereign over that, so that he will save those Gentiles and Jews of his choosing. And he will save the fullness of them. He will save those he elects, and not one of them will be missed out. And now we've established what we mean by all Israel will be saved, what that means. So we can say then with some confidence that God has not finished with Israel. He's not said, well, I'm forgetting about Israel, whether we mean that those who live in the land of Israel or those Jews around the world. And so we should be concerned for them in prayer at the very least. And some, because of that, would assume that therefore there'll be this sort of future last push of large numbers coming to Christ before he returns. I don't actually think this passage demands that either, but it doesn't rule that out either. We just don't know. It just means God has not finished with them. So one of the books I was reading preparing for this, actually wasn't a book on Romans, but about particularly about this thing about Israel. And he talks about a period in the 70s where UCLA, so one of the universities in California, University College, Los Angeles, UCLA had these missions, and thousands of Jews came to Christ. In 1 year, there were 6,000. Now, I think at the moment, UCLA has 45,000 students. I think it's about 10,000 fewer then. That means 10 or 20% of the campus were not just Christians, but Jews had become Christians, which is remarkable sort of numbers. So there may be times, there will be times when things like that may happen. And other times it may be a trickle. So I don't think the passage demands that, you know, we see lots of Jews become Christians. Oh, it must be Jesus about to come. Neither does it mean absence of it means that he couldn't come at any moment. It just means God has not finished with the Jews and with Israel yet. And part of the point of these chapters is that it's for us to take comfort that God is at work no matter what we see, and that he can be trusted. He's good for his promises. Rather than a checklist on some chart to work out the time of Christ's return. So we've seen this passage is not really about Christ's return. It's about his first coming and the cross, and therefore securing for out into the future those whom he would save, Jew and Gentile. Also, when the fullness of the Gentiles is in, then all Israel will be saved. Now, what we've noticed the last few weeks is there's a place for mission to the Jews, but also that all world mission and all local mission has an impact on Israel. All mission everywhere impacts everywhere else, and everyone needs reaching. That means the little conversation that you have with someone at work or in a shop or wherever, we perhaps even just get a few seconds, if that, to share a little something about the gospel or about the Lord and what he's done for you. Here and there, normally don't get an opportunity to do a grand presentation, do you? Those times when you're just assisting someone at church who's trying to do an evangelistic, a guest event of sorts. Just turning up when we're in person, just turning up at a guest event, or even actually just being a number on YouTube. That just that encouragement that someone else is here with us. Doing something practical to help. Opening up a home and hosting people. It's not just that it's not insignificant because we're helping each other, but it is what you're doing. You might be thinking, well, I'm not an articulate evangelist, but what you're doing is a part of global mission and serving in God's eternal plan. God is using you. You know, just being, giving someone a lift to something, bringing a pudding to an event, just being a smiley face in the room. It's a much bigger deal than you think. And God uses not just to bring one person to faith. That would sound amazing, wouldn't it? But it's part of his eternal plan. What appears to be a bit of niche theology that's taking three chapters to talk about, so probably means it's significant, is actually there for our encouragement. Frequently things look desperate. The world, maybe our own situation. The thought of church growth looks impossible. We thought about that this morning in John 6. Even when there is encouraging growth, it's against the backdrop of a task that is so huge that we feel very small. Other times we feel no signs of encouragement at all. But what this bit of Romans is telling us is that it's never a hopeless task. It's never that God has stopped working. God always is working out his eternal plan. Our job is to remain faithful.